This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Margiet Williams, a research officer at the School of Psychology at Bangor University, and Judy Hutchings, professor of psychology at the same institution. Margiet has written the ACAM topic guide on parenting, which Judy has overseen. Welcome, both of you. Thanks for joining me. Can we start with some introductions?
As you say, my name is Margiet Williams and I'm a research officer at Bangor University. I've been here for nearly 10 years now, research work around parenting and implementation.
Right, yes, I'm Judy Hutchings. I'm a professor of clinical psychology at Bangor and I established the Centre for Evidence-Based Early Intervention in which Margiet and I work. I had 37 years in the health service as a consultant clinical psychologist, working primarily with families with children with severe behaviour problems. But alongside that, I've had 25 years of work within the university as a researcher and established the centre where we've got a lot of different work going on, not only on parenting, but also around school-based interventions for bullying and to promote effective social emotional skills.
What are the risk factors associated with the development of behavioural problems in children?
Well, there's many different factors. So you can have some biological ones, such as the incidence of behaviour problems are much higher in boys than they are in girls. Gender is often considered to be a risk factor. There are also things like language delay. Children with poorer language are more likely to have behaviour problems, which is usually associated with the fact that they're more frustrated with not being able to get over their needs. Children who grow up in socioeconomically disadvantaged households are more likely to have behaviour problems. And then also things like harsh and inconsistent parenting is a risk factor for developing behaviour problems. Mothers who have high levels of depression are more likely to have children with behaviour problems.
That I'd like to add to that, because one of the seminal pieces of work that was done, I mean, it was from the Oregon Social Learning Center and Jerry Patterson and his team. And one of his studies looked at all the factors that appeared to be correlated with children having behavior problems. So it was single parents, young parents, maternal mental health problems, poverty, unemployment. They actually analyzed the data. They found that although they were correlated, it wasn't causal. What was causal was whether or not those factors had impact on parenting. So I think it's really important that we say that there are quite a lot of very poor families with a lot of socially disadvantaging circumstances that do a very good job bringing up their kids. But it's whether or not the range or the extent of disadvantage impacts on parenting, and it's the parenting behaviour that is associated with the child behaviour.
So given that, what factors make a parent at greater risk of poor parenting?
Well, of course, some children are harder to parent, so we have to acknowledge child factors. You know, say premature babies, for example, are likely to be much harder to parent. Because they're likely to have difficulties with feeding and all sorts of things. And, you know, sadly, you know, premature babies are at greater risk of child protection problems. So we know that there's all sorts of factors. There are the individual circumstances of the parent. There are the what the child brings to that situation. And there are broader social impacts. I mean, another factor is of course, depression. Or depression. Now, Margiet and I have published on depression because I think it's a really interesting topic, partly because in all the studies that we've ever done, if you input parenting, you get improvements in maternal mental health because you're teaching a set of skills that can benefit both the maternal depression and the child behaviour. Because another of the factors that's clear from the relationship between parents and children with behaviour problems is that parents are very poor at observing what's actually happening. In fact, we did some work on autobiographical memory, and we showed that parents of kids with behaviour problems don't have specific memories. If you ask them to give you a specific example of what the child does, well, he's always bad. You know, he never behaves and he never follows an instruction. And it's not true when you observe them, of course. It's just that parents don't have clear observation of what's actually happening. And then therefore their problem solving is poor and their attempts to change the child's behaviour are likely to become inappropriate.
And when a child has behavioural problems, as you've described, it then impacts the whole family. Can you describe some of the sort of typical knock-on effects this has?
With the coercion theory, when you get escalating levels of coercive or aggressive behaviour within a family, this can affect not just the parent and the child who are caught in the cycle, but also the other parents and the other siblings within the household. Child behaviour problems are associated with increased economic and social burden on families. Parents will say that their lives are quite restricted on a day-to-day basis in that they can't go and visit friends because their child always misbehaves. They can't go to shops because the child will have a tantrum and they won't be able to cope with that. Can't go to new places. But there's also lots of research that shows that child behaviour problems are actually very costly, and not just to families, but also to services, of how many times they're referred to the GP because they've had an accident, because they've climbed the tree outside and fallen or something like that, but also to society as a whole. Professor Stephen Scott in King's College London did some work quite a few years ago now on the economic cost of child behaviour problems. And the figures were astronomical compared to other childhood disorders.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the interventions that are done. But before we go on to that, can you just say something about prevalence? How many families are we talking about here?
Well, the global prevalence for childhood behaviour problems is about 5.5% aged between, I think it's about between 2 and 10. 5% of them will have a behaviour problem.
Some of the studies of really severely socially disadvantaged communities demonstrate rates of 20 or 25% of parents scoring their children within the clinical range.
That's huge. And what are the most common disorders in children that are associated with behavioural problems?
Associated with behaviour problems, these would be things like conduct disorder or oppositional defiant disorder, and even attention deficit hyperactivity disorder as well.
And I've read that the prognosis for children with early onset conduct disorder is poor, both in the short term and the long term. So I want to talk about what can be done to mitigate this.
Yeah, maybe we should be clear first about what the long-term prognosis is. Untreated, it's terrible. When you see those long-term effects, it's not just behavioural problems, it's emotional problems as well, because alongside having high rates of substance misuse and aggression and so on, you know, you get very high rates of emotional disorders as well, and, you know, suicidal ideation and all sorts of things that demonstrating that those young people are pretty unhappy. When you look at the adult prison population, for example, you know, a very high proportion of these of folks that end up in prison have come through were identified or could have been identified when they were quite young for having significant behavioural challenges. So it's a very long-term issue, and there are longitudinal studies like the ones done in Oregon or in Dunedin or even in Britain as well that have shown really these long-term effects of untreated conduct disorder. David Farrington at Cambridge, for example, has done years of work showing long-term effects of childhood behavioural difficulties.
Right. So basically the cost of doing, the emotional and financial cost of doing nothing is astronomical, is what you're saying.
Yes, and one of the things that we've always done is we've tried to make sure that we did a cost analysis alongside the programmes that we've evaluated. So sometimes you could call it cost effectiveness, but you can say, how much it costs to get an improvement. So we've always heard of what it was costing to deliver the intervention, what kind of improvement we got. And we've worked with our health economics department here at the university, who've been partners with us on many of our studies, because we think that the cost issue is a really significant one.
Let's talk about positive parenting practices. Can you explain what positive parenting looks like?
In most of the positive, in the parenting interventions, there are five key positive parenting practices. One of these is relationship building. So this is where a parent would spend time with their child, doing joint activities, getting to know their child and building and strengthening their relationship. Your typical parents will have a good relationship with their children already and will already be doing these sorts of activities on a day-to-day basis. But for those families who have high challenged children, they might not be having those sort of interactions because of other circumstances. And therefore, their relationships need this sort of strengthening in order to establish that parent as a reinforcer for behaviour.
We've just done a components study to look at which components of parenting programmes are necessary or effective. And that took programs that were delivered all the way across from universal, preventive, selective, and clinical interventions. And the other components, which are the praise and rewards, giving clear instructions, setting clear limits, and having effective non-violent discipline strategies when kids do things that you really wish to reduce, they're important across the board. But the relationship building turned out to be important for the clinical population, but didn't have any impact on more universal focused programs. And that relates back to what I was saying about the coercive process, really, that when you have that coercive process that's been brought about by increasing child behavior problems and increasing parental aggressive and coercive strategies for trying to deal with it, then the relationship between the parent and the child is poor, and you're not going to help the parent to be able to help the child to learn until the child feels like the parent's on their side. So the purpose of that relationship building is about letting the child know that they matter to the parent as a human being, and that their parent thinks that they are important, because then when the parent praises the child or even asks the child to do something, it's much more likely that it's going to be effective.
The web-based parenting support programme, is that the Coping Confident Parenting Programme?
Yes. At the moment, as we've initially developed it, it's just, I think, an 8-session programme with a couple of sessions of revision that just show parents key parenting skills, like how to give an effective instruction, for example, to say, you know, rather than tell a child what not to do, tell them what to do. So it's no good saying stop shouting when you want them to talk in a quiet voice. So they've got examples like that, and they've got videos like that, and parents can access them themselves. They can look at the videos, they can see examples, they can do little quizzes to see whether they have understood the effective components and so on. We're hoping that we'll evaluate it. We just, when we did our first evaluation, it was just given to parents to do once a week if they wanted to. We're hoping to get funding to do a comparison between just access on your own to access where you might have some kind of support from a health visitor or someone in between the sessions. And then we can see whether it was also beneficial to families that were having perhaps more challenges.
Okay. You talked at the beginning, you used the term harsh parenting, and you also talked about lax parenting. I mean, what is harsh
parenting? Well, the trouble with lax parenting is when a parent doesn't set limits, that they occasionally get pretty fed up and then use harsh strategies to try and address the situation. So they're not kind of two separate things in a way. But when we talk about harsh parenting, there's a whole range of things. There are emotionally negative things that are said to children. There's removing problems. And so they might punish children by trying to stop them having television time or different things. So if the focus is on the reduction of problem behavior rather than on
the replacement of problem behaviours. So the whole focus in every programme that we're involved in is, what do you want instead? You know, if you punish a child, then they might just run away. Punishment doesn't work effectively to teach a new behaviour. So the whole focus of all of the work across the board is about helping people to work out, what do you want instead? Your child's having a tantrum. What do you want instead? Well, of course, if they're having a tantrum, they can be having it for a whole lot of different reasons. I might be having a tantrum because I'm inattentive and hyperactive, and every time I build a little tower, I end up knocking it down by mistake, and I have a tantrum because people come and help me. Or I might have a tantrum because you tell me to go to bed and I don't want to go, and I have a tantrum and you just back off and let me. So there's a whole range of different reasons. So problem behavior doesn't define why it's there. You have to then look at what are the reasons.
Right. And with that particularly challenging population, the clinical population, are there any specific additional strategies that are taught that have been shown to be effective?
Not so much the strategies. I think it's more to do with engagement. Some work that we published in 2004 that's been repeated by other people since shows that the high challenge families particularly, they're not going to do what you tell them. Because actually telling people what to do is the least effective way of changing behaviour in the world anyway. Otherwise, GPs could go home tomorrow because we'd all eat a healthy diet and give up smoking and not drink too much alcohol and take exercise every day. But, you know, we've got massive problems in our society that are caused by lifestyle, and particularly our very disadvantaged families who've probably not benefited from education very much, who not likely to do as they're told. Then we know that if you bring them into parenting programs where you are empowering them through a process of discussion, rehearsal, identifying their goals, identifying their skills and assets that you can build on, working collaboratively. So the first thing is having the social learning theory content, lots of praise, clear limits, good instructions, all those kind of things. Second thing is getting people to do it. And that requires this collaborative process whereby people are engaged to help themselves. So it's using counselling skills and identifying parents' own goals and supporting them with them. And then the third thing is access, because if you're poor and you've got a couple of kids under five and you know you're a single parent and there's a program going on down the road in the nearest town that you've got to get there at 9:30 in the morning, then if somebody doesn't actually support you by giving you a taxi or the bus fare or childcare or all those other things, or preferably a meal when you get there as well or something like that, so then you're not going to get there.
Margaret, can you say a little bit about the parenting program for parents of children with autism spectrum disorder in specialist children's services across North and Mid Wales? I understand you're currently evaluating that. Can you say anything about any of the interim findings?
Yeah, so we've just done a small trial to see if the program can be delivered in local services, to see whether parents attend, whether parents like the program, whether those people who delivered the program like it, and whether they think it's a good fit for their service. And we took some measures to see whether they were appropriate for the families and things. We just wanted to see whether we can use this program in regular services. The reason that we decided to work with this population is autism spectrum disorders often have co-occurring behavior problems which have come alongside with the core symptoms of autism. So it's something that it's very, very common, and it's something that's very challenging for families. We've worked with the Incredible Years Autism Spectrum and Language Delay Program. So the Incredible Years is a suite of parenting programs and programs for teachers and children, which are shown to be very effective. But this was a very new program. It was only developed in 2015, so we felt that we wanted to do something with it. And the results from the study, which we've just completed a couple of months ago now, is that, yes, parents really did like the program. There was really good attendance rates.
we were able to deliver it in local specialist children's services. The staff really liked the programme, really appreciated the supervision that they were given to deliver the programme, and very preliminary findings in terms of improvements in parental praise, increases in positive parenting, decreases in behaviour problems for the children, some decreases in the number of commands that parents were giving their children, so the number of instructions. This was actually the first trial in the world to look at this programme in particular in a randomised controlled trial design.
I wanted to ask you about this issue of timing, because is there a window in which acquiring and using positive parenting skills makes a difference? So in other words, at what point is it too late to alter entrenched behaviours, or is it never too late?
Well, we certainly got evidence up till age 10 or 11. We've been doing a pooling study led by Francis Gardner at Oxford, where we've pulled together data from, I think it's 14 incredible years trials across Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Ireland, UK, Wales. And one of the things that we've looked at was whether the older kids in our sample, and we had something like 2,000 children, I think, in the sample in total, whether the older kids did as well as the younger ones, and they did. So we didn't find an age effect in terms of having less good outcomes for the children aged 7 and over than the children who were younger. So certainly on that basis, we would say that it's never too late. You know, it may be easier perhaps when histories are shorter, you know, when the behaviour problem's not as well established and when the child hasn't got into school and got into other environments where they're behaviour problems are also evident. But our data from that study showed that the programmes were equally effective with children up to that age range. Some of the studies of teenagers and programmes targeting teenagers are more challenging because the evidence certainly shows that for a parenting programme associated with teenagers, you need the teenager to be involved as well as the parent. So if the teenager doesn't get involved, then you can't implement a program. So there are different barriers there.
What else is new in the pipeline that excites you?
Well, we're currently doing quite a bit of international work. So we do work with low and middle income countries around parenting. And one of the trials that we are involved in at the moment in Southeastern Europe is what's called a MOST trial. So that's a multi-phase optimization strategy trial, which Judy can explain.
To just backtrack a little bit from that, I've been working for quite a few years now with people to try to develop low-cost programs, parenting programs for use in low and middle-income countries. And of course, in the low and middle-income countries, you get higher rates of violence towards children, higher rates of intimate partner violence, and higher rates of pretty well every other stressor that you can imagine. So the need, and the World Health Organization have been taking the lead on this with UNICEF in terms of looking at how to support parenting in poor countries. And so I was involved in a trial of developing a program and evaluating it in South Africa. And we then took it to the Philippines. And this is the program that now is being evaluated in this Eastern Europe trial. And that's one of a series of programs that we've called Parenting for Lifelong Health. And they include a home visiting program for mothers with young babies, a book sharing program to encourage parent-child interactions and children's language, and then a parenting program for 2 to 9 year olds and one for teenagers. And of that range of programs, it's the 2 to 9 program that we're evaluating in Eastern Europe. And we're evaluating it in terms of, given that poor countries don't have much money to spend, how much is necessary in order to help to bring about effective changes for parents who've got children with challenges. So we're comparing in our MOST trial, we're comparing a short program with a long program. We're comparing whether or not you provide incentives to people to attend. And we're comparing, particularly that interests me, the extent to which supervision of people delivering the programs makes a difference. In other words, how much effort do you need to put in to making programs effective in places that haven't got much money?
Margaret, you've written the ACAM topic guide on parenting, and I'm sure we've covered some of the themes already, but can you give a short summary of what you've included in this guide?
Well, the guide was a very general overview of parenting and of the kind of the research aspects associated. I gave a quick overview of the state of play, so the prevalence of childhood behaviour problems and what the risk factors are and the prognosis for children. And then I talked a bit about what effect parenting has on child behaviour problems and how we can support parenting in terms of interventions. I've also talked about the different ways that these interventions are delivered. So you have things like group-based programs, individual face-to-face programs, but you also have things like self-directed. So these are like the online programs, which are becoming much more prevalent these days. There's quite a lot of research around at the moment about online programs for behavior change. I also talked a bit about the different types of programs that you have. So I think Judy touched on that earlier in terms of programs that are targeting a universal population. So these are the parents of children that are not showing any risk factors for behavior problems. But then you have some selected populations. So these are subgroups with elevated risk factors, so it could be single parents or teenage parents, for example, but their children might not necessarily show any levels of behavior problems. And then if you keep going up the ladder, you have selected populations. So these are people who have risk factors for developing child behavior problems. So again, social economic disadvantage or single parents, but that their children are also showing elevated levels of behavior problems. And then at the top of the ladder, you have the clinical populations. So these are the children that show clinical levels or very significant levels of challenging behavior. Some of the things we need to do more research on. So there's not much research on the engagement of fathers. So Judy said before that in a lot of our research, but also in parenting research in general, when we talk about the primary caregiver, we're mostly talking about mothers. But of course, there needs to be a lot more done with fathers or even with couples together as such. But it's a very underdeveloped research area that needs more work, really.
I just wanted to talk a little bit for a minute about language. The surveys at the moment are showing huge numbers of children arriving at school with language delay. And there are obviously clearly big social changes occurring in the lives of families. So our children are often not eating at the same time as parents or not eating the same things. They may be spending time in their rooms. They may be spending vast amounts of time on screens. They probably don't get much exercise because we're frightened to let them go out to play. So there are quite a lot of changes that are quite significant. And among them are that children and parents are spending less time talking to one another. Not all parents, not all children, but children that aren't read to, children that don't spend time with parents talking and describing. But so it is a massive issue. But when you think about the role of language, right, first of all, we just use it to ask for things like a drink or a ball or something. And then we use it to have conversations and interact with other people around us. And eventually we use it to manage our own behavior. So we self-instruct. We say, I'm trying to do this or I'm trying to understand. And if you go to school and your language skills are poor and then Freddie won't play with you, you thump him because you don't have the language skills to use for problem solving to say to yourself, well, Freddie doesn't want to play with me. What shall I do about it? Well, I'll go and ask Margiad if she'll play with me, or I'll ask somebody else. If you haven't got the problem solving skills that come with language, then you're very likely to demonstrate antisocial aggressive responses to situations. And we know that it's a massive growing problem. So a couple of the programs we're working on have been trying to address that. We've been using the book sharing program that was developed for South Africa as part of the Parenting for Lifelong Health. But that encourages parents to play with books with children. It's having conversations with children, asking them, what do you think is going to happen next? Or how do you think Red Riding Hood's feeling? And using it to promote children's language. So we've got that program, and then we're doing other things as well around promoting children's language, because we know that socially disadvantaged children are much more likely to start school with significant language deficits, engaging parents in building the skills that children will need to benefit not only academically but socially as well are really significant programs and things that we should be working on, and we are.
We've covered a lot. Is there anything you'd like to say that I haven't asked, perhaps as a takeaway message for those listening to this podcast?
I guess that from our work with schools, I would also want to say that even if it's impossible to work with parents sometimes, and there will be parenting situations where parents are struggling to an extent that we can't engage them, it's really important that schools know that they can make a difference. Because I spent quite a lot of time in school staff rooms where the teachers and other people just say effectively, well, you know, if this child had the right parenting, we could do something with them, and feel gloomy because of the deficits and the problems that children are bringing to school. But, you know, we can be effective, and we've done quite a lot of school-based programs. In fact, we're developing a training program for classroom support staff at the moment. And of course, they're a group that end up with the kids with the most severe challenges in school, but they're also the least trained group of people.
Okay. Margaret and Judy, thank you ever so much. You can find Dr. Margaret Williams' topic guide on parenting, which includes input from Professor Judy Hutchings, on the ACAM website. That's www.acam.org. And Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.